Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, brought to you by Money Magazine, creating financial freedom for Australians since 1999.
Hello and thanks for joining us for another episode of Friends with Money, Money Magazine's podcast to help you earn, save and achieve your financial goals. My name is Tom Watson, a senior journalist here at Money Magazine, and as always, it is a pleasure to be with you. Every summer, I have these grand plans to sort out a bunch of financial and life admin. So every summer, I draw up a list and without fail, making a will goes right at the top of it. You guess it though, at the end of every summer, it's still there, left unchecked, uncrossed out. With so much, you know, to focus on when it comes to actually living our lives, it's pretty understandable that many of us put off planning for death though. But for anyone with dependents, family, friends, you know, it's obviously a really important thing to think about and more importantly, to do. And as we'll get into on today's episode, there's more to estate planning than just making a will. Righto, we've got plenty to discuss today, so let's crack into it. But before we do, I need to introduce today's guest. So on that note, I'm very pleased to say that joining us for his debut on Friends with Money is William Moore, partner and head of private client advisory at Hall & Wilcox. Will, welcome. Many thanks for joining us on Friends with Money.
Pleasure, Tom. Thank you for asking us to come along and have a chat. Great topic.
It's a very relevant topic, as I mentioned for myself, and I'm sure many of our listeners. So hopefully lots of practical bits and pieces for people to take out. Will, if we can, let's start with the area that people, you know, probably most associate with estate planning, something that, as I've mentioned, I've so clearly struggled with over the past couple of years, and that's wills. So I guess fundamentally, why should someone have a will and, or, you know, put a different way, what's the danger of not having one in place?
How long do we have to talk about dangers, Tom? There's many of them. Perhaps reasons why to have a will. A lot of people want certainty in their life, and what a will does is it provides certainty. It makes sure that the will maker can appoint people to carry out certain roles, such as acting as their executor. That's the person who executes the terms of the will, and also setting out how they want assets to pass through to beneficiaries. So people can be quite specific in how they do that. You can include structures in the will which might provide better benefits for people receiving the inheritances, called the beneficiaries. And it also generally gives those beneficiaries and those people that are left behind a much greater outcome, much more certainty and less risk as a result of all of those things.
That all makes sense, Will. I guess a follow-up to that, I assume, again, not having made a will myself, I assume that the wills aren't, you know, kind of one and done type things, that they do require updating from time to time. So when might that be the case for someone to, I guess, check in and potentially redo their will?
It's a good point. And they certainly aren't one and done. And unfortunately, a lot of the issues that we see are either where people don't have a will in place or they have put one in place, say, 20 years ago. And since that, they've got divorced, they've remarried, they've had children, there's been a significant life event. And they're really the sorts of things that we need to be focused on, Tom, in the sense of if you do have something in place, making sure that it's kept up to date. You know, so many of those issues that we see come about because people haven't kept them up to date. And I touched on a few examples there. Now, if you make a will and then you marry someone, that can potentially invalidate part or all of the will. Again, if you divorce, that can have an impact on a will. If you prepare a will at a point in time where you don't have children and then you subsequently have children, again, that's another key factor in making sure that you keep that will up to date.
So life events that are, you know, are worth triggering a bit of action or perhaps a conversation about wills then.
Absolutely. The other big one that comes up sometimes, Tom, is inheritances or liquidity events. So if you've got listeners out there who are business owners, for example, and they have a business sale and they receive a cash injection or someone in their family has passed away and they get an inheritance, there are often instances as well where people should sit down, they should take stock of those new circumstances, go back and have a look at their documents and make sure that those documents are still accurate and reflect the circumstances.
Beyond wills, Will, I knew I'd stumble on that. I'm sorry. I'm sure you get that all the time. So beyond wills, I guess the second thing that I had in my head when it came to estate planning is setting up a power of attorney. Now, Is that even the correct term? And I guess if it is, what's the importance of naming one?
Very, very important. Unfortunately, with our population in Australia, we've got quite an aging population, and quite a lot of those baby boomers are moving into their 70s and 80s. And when we look at statistics and we look at incapacity in particular, Tom, it's becoming a real point of difficulty with a lot of our clients. And where the powers of attorney become really important is they allow people to appoint attorneys, decision makers, in the event they've lost capacity to help out and to make decisions for them. In terms of the specific names, it does change from state to state. They're all slightly different, but if I can talk about it in a general sense, you generally tend to have two. One of them would be an appointment of medical treatment decision maker or an appointment of enduring guardian. That's more of a medically focused document, which allows you to appoint people to make medical treatment decisions. So if we're in a car accident, for example, we need an operation, we can't give consent because we've lost capacity, that's where those people would step in.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, that's more so medical type decisions and also lifestyle type decisions as well, depending on the jurisdiction. So aged care becoming more and more of a consideration. You know, you've got 425,000 Australians in 2024 that had a diagnosis of dementia. So there's a lot of flow-ons from that. That's expected to go up to around 1 million people in about 2065. So that aged care decision, that supported living decision, is becoming more and more important. And again, the attorneys who are appointed under those documents will be able to make those decisions on behalf of those people. The other document that sort of sits under that broad category of power of attorney is the enduring power of attorney. And that's more so geared towards the financial decisions and the legal decisions. So again, if you've lost capacity, or even if you just want someone to help you out, a number of our clients that are getting on in years, they often find it difficult to deal with technology. They find it hard to get out and do things. So they might appoint, you know, a trusted friend or a family member or an advisor to be their attorney to help with paying bills, to help with dealing with banks. You know, it's always good if you've got an attorney who's stuck on the phone with Telstra for half an hour instead of you, for example, something like that, just to help you out with those things. And again, it's really a case of having that document in place, having the right people, and then you've got a plan. If you don't have those documents in place, it's not be all and end all. There are tribunals in each state and territory that allow for the appointment of administrators, which is financial and legal decisions, or guardians, which is more of those medical and personal type decisions as well. So in Victoria, for example, that's VCAT, but that changes again from state to state.
It's a really, really good explainer, Will. Thank you. I'm sure people will find that really useful to know. I definitely didn't realize there was that kind of distinction. So as I said, good thing to know about. Moving on, I'd like to bring up one of our favorite subjects on Friends with Money, which is superannuation. Specifically, though, I feel like we should touch on super beneficiaries, you know, the person who will get your super if you die. So are you able to explain to us, I guess, what the process is here in regards to naming a beneficiary, but also why it's not quite as straightforward as I guess people might assume it would be?
Absolutely. And Tom, this goes back to your very first comment about the estate plan not just being about a will. It's got a lot of different components to it. So we've talked about wills, we've talked about powers of attorney. Superannuation is also one of those key components. So in terms of your superannuation and your benefits, it's not a case that you can name any person as a beneficiary. So the beneficiary is the person who can receive those benefits on your death, which are called death benefits. The superannuation legislation actually says there's only a certain group of people who can receive that. And this is often an issue that we see where people haven't had advice. They've prepared their death benefit nomination, which is the document that determines where they want their superannuation to pass. They've prepared that themselves and they've got it wrong because they've put someone in there who's not actually able to receive it under the superannuation laws. So what the superannuation laws essentially say is a dependent is a spouse. So that can be a married spouse, a de facto spouse. It's a child. It's your estate. And it's someone who's financially dependent on you or in an interdependency relationship. The issue we often see is people might name their parents or they might name their siblings as beneficiaries. Neither of those people are beneficiaries unless they fit in some kind of financial dependency or interdependency relationship. And that's often when we see issues. And where that becomes an issue, Tom, is because it's invalid, it then falls back on the trustee of the fund to then go through a process to work out who's actually eligible to receive those benefits. And you get an outcome where the benefits end up going to someone potentially other than who the owner of that superannuation intended them to go to. So there are ways to get it to parents, there are ways to get it to siblings, but you've got to get it into your estate first, and then you have to distribute it through the terms of your will.
I was just thinking as you're saying that, Will, before my partner and myself named each other as beneficiaries, I'm pretty sure I had my dad down, and I'm pretty sure she had a sister down. So definitely would have fallen victim to that. Yeah. Good example.
The other thing I might add to that as well, Tom, which is quite an important issue, is the actual document where you name those people. That's the death benefit nomination. This is an area where we're seeing more and more disputes and more issues. It's really, really important for the listeners, if they are filling those documents out, to make sure that they read the instructions that go with those documents and that they execute those documents correctly. Because if you don't follow the requirements, it will be invalid. And then again, it goes back to the trustee to have to go through a complex process. Most of the industry funds and retail funds are fairly good at giving instructions about what needs to be done. For those listeners that have got self-managed super funds, it's determined by the terms of the trust fund deed, and they can be quite peculiar. There's been a number of cases recently where the courts have said that it's invalid because it hasn't complied with a particular requirement, and that then goes back into a court process. So getting advice, making sure it's done properly, yes, it does cost money, but it can ultimately save a significant amount of money, a significant amount of time, and most importantly, a significant amount of stress on the beneficiaries and the people that are left behind by getting it done properly in the first place.
Another great point, Will. One of the areas, or the area, I should say, that I was really, really interested in, they're all very interesting areas, but this one in particular definitely caught my eye, is about digital assets and in the context of estate planning. And I know it's a large area, but can you give us an idea of, I guess, the relevant assets and other bits and pieces in this space, Will, and again, why it's such a crucial thing for people to think about in this day and age?
I mean, probably the most common types of digital assets that we come across, Tom, are things such as social media accounts, things such as items that are stored on the cloud, so photos, music accounts, for example. And then the other significant one is things like crypto. You know, there's a lot of money that's sitting in various forms of crypto, which are held in wallets. And when you look at the value of Bitcoin, for example, you know, especially in more recent times, that's increased significantly in value. So there's a lot of clients who potentially have significant wealth that's sitting in those digital assets. And because they're digital, you need passwords, you need codes to get into them. And that's often a significant issue because if those codes, those passwords get lost, if people don't know what they are or where they are or how to access them, often you can get stuck and you lose them. And, you know, there's been some pretty significant wallets that have been lost with crypto with, you know, 80,000 Bitcoins in them and so on and so forth. And that's a significant amount of money.
I definitely wouldn't want to be the person who didn't write down a password and their beneficiary missed out on that.
But a lot of it comes back to that point, Tom, in the sense of the more that people can be organized, the more that people have, you know, like a key contacts list, these are the people that you need to speak to. And then these are the assets. So what the asset is, where it can be accessed. And then ideally, they will have a storage system with their passwords. So whoever their executor is, whoever their attorney is, can do what they can to actually deal with those accounts. You know, to memorialize a Facebook page or to close it down, for example, to deal with the crypto wallet, so on and so forth, in accordance with the instructions that have been left as part of the estate plan.
Actually, I had a conversation with my partner before we came on about exactly that, about my meager cryptocurrency holdings and how she can access them if I ever get hit by a bus or anything like that. So she was, didn't even know they were there. So I'm definitely glad that we had that chat.
The good thing there, though, is a lot of the wallets, a lot of the actual platforms are getting better at setting up systems and processes so that if someone does die, there is a backup sort of system that's in place. So if people are looking to get into that space, it's always good to think about, well, what can actually happen if I lose capacity or I die? What's the backup system to make sure that someone can access this?
Will, before we, I guess, start to wrap up, I also want to get your thoughts on an area that might be more relevant to beneficiaries of an estate rather than the benefactor, although please do tell me if I'm wrong.
Yep.
Again, I know it's a large area. So are you able to touch on some of the potential, I guess, tax implications for someone who inherits a house or super or crypto yep. assets or whatever it might be?
And Tom, this is, again, a critical point, because having the right plan in place and having the right structures, especially through the will, through the superannuation, can make a significant difference in this particular point. And it often gets overlooked. People often think about when I'm preparing my will about myself and not necessarily thinking about the end beneficiaries. Tax is a big one. So thinking about the asset, thinking about who's going to receive it and the best way for them to receive it is really important. So with a home, for example, if it's a residential home, there's a 2-year capital gains tax exemption. So provided it's sold and settled within 2 years of the date of death, there is no capital gains tax on it, for example. But other assets such as shares, other assets such as a investment property, they will have tax consequences when they pass through to beneficiaries. So including structures like a testamentary trust in a will can give a lot more flexibility. Testamentary trust is like a discretionary trust or a family trust. It's built into the terms of the will, doesn't come into existence until someone dies. A number of great benefits. It gives a lot of flexibility in the tax space. So for tax planning, to sit down with advisors and to look at optimizing tax. There's some concessional tax treatment for minors. So a lot of clients are always conscious about helping their children and potentially grandchildren with school fees. Testamentary trusts allow about $22,500 of tax-free income to be distributed to a minor per year, as opposed to $416 from a trust that you set up during your lifetime. So there's a significant difference there. They also help with asset protection. They can also help a little bit in a family law context, not bulletproof, but putting the beneficiaries in a better position. So all of those things are really good reasons for having testamentary trusts. The other one's also just thinking about the beneficiaries and the assets themselves. So with superannuation, that's another really important one, and it's one that is ever increasing in value. If the superannuation passes to someone who's considered a dependent for tax purposes, such as a spouse, or a dependent child, that will pass through tax-free. Whereas if it passes to someone who is not a tax dependent, such as an adult independent child, it'll get taxed on the taxable component at 15% if it goes to the individual directly, plus the Medicare levy, or if it goes into the estate, it's just 15%. So thinking about that, you know, blended families, for example, are a quite a good one where we often talk about leaving superannuation, and if there's life insurance built into the super fund, leaving that possibly to the second spouse and then potentially other assets to children from the first marriage. So there's lots of different ways of doing it, but sitting down and thinking about the tax consequences can be quite a big value driver for the clients, but also for the end beneficiaries as well.
Well, we've in some ways we touched on a lot today, but in others I feel like we're only just is touching scratching the surface. That's exactly the phrase that I was looking for. You should turn host, and I'll come and do your job. Now, before we let you go, Will, I guess the final thing I wanted to ask you is if you got a final tip or a piece of advice or something you'd like to leave us with for listeners to chew on.
Yeah, get it done at the end of the day, Tom. You know, we've talked about ticking this off the list. It's not difficult to get done. Get proper advice. If you work with someone who knows what they're doing, you know, there's accredited specialists out there who just do wills and estates work, such as myself. The benefit of doing that is we've got a clear process. We know what the risks are. We know what the benefits of the right structures are. I see a lot of estate disputes as well. So many of those disputes come up because people don't have a plan in place, or they've got a plan in place, but they did that 20 years ago and circumstances have changed. And I get really frustrated because I'd say, you know, 70-80% of those disputes can be avoided if people just kept their plans. Either they put them in place, or once they're in place, they just kept them up to date. You know, it reduces the chance of issues. It provides everyone with certainty. It gives people the opportunity, so the beneficiaries, to have the right structures. And if you do that, it's going to give you the best chance of leaving a legacy and not a liability for the beneficiaries of your estate.
What a perfect, perfect place to leave things on. Will, this has been an immensely interesting and you know, above all, practical chat, which is our favorite kind of chat on Friends with Money. You've definitely left me with a bit of a to-do list in my head as well. So I'm sure that's the same with many of our listeners. Many thanks for joining us today. It's been a pleasure having you on. And listen, we'd love to have you back on the show in the future as well. So until then, it's been a pleasure.
Pleasure. Thank you, Tom. And hopefully we'll speak again soon.
That is it for this episode of the Friends with Money podcast. But don't forget to jump on our website, moneymag.com.au, for your daily dose of financial news. Or you can go grab the latest copy of Money Magazine in all good newsagents. As always, Friends with Money will be right back in your podcast feed next week. So until then, my name is Tom Watson. Goodbye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Friends with Money podcast. For credible, independent, and easy to understand financial commentary, visit moneymag.com.au. Please remember that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are general in nature, and further independent advice and research based on your personal circumstances should be sought before making an investment decision.